You're listening to the Radiator 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Kristen Kimball. This is an interview from the archives from 2011. Kristen Kimball is the author of The Dirty Life on Farming, Food, and Love. Before I air the interview with Kristen and before I give you her bio, I want to mention that I do have a new interview this week with Stephen Kirkjian, who is the author of a book called Master Thieves, which is about the Gardner Museum heist. The Gardner Museum was robbed 25 years ago this month, and Stephen Kirkjian is a retired Boston Globe reporter who has written a really fascinating book about the heist. That book will be released tomorrow, and all media has been asked to wait on any interviews until tomorrow. So what I've decided to do is run a rerun today, a wonderful rerun with Kristen Kimball, who was a great guest. And then tomorrow, if you go to the podcast site, you can find the interview with Stephen, and I will be airing that on the Radiator at a later date as well. So, onward. Today we'll play an interview from the archives with Kristen Kimball, author of The Dirty Life on Farming, Food, and Love. Kristen Kimball is a farmer and a writer living in northern New York. Born in 1971, Kristen grew up in central New York. She graduated from Harvard in 1994, then moved to New York City, where she worked at a literary agency, taught creative writing, and freelanced for magazines and travel guides. In 2002, she interviewed a man that she refers to in her bio as, quote, a wingnut farmer named Mark, and she took more than a professional interest in both him and his vocation. They founded Essex Farm together in 2004. It's the world's first full diet CSA, as far as they know. And Kristen has been professionally dirty ever since. She and Mark have two daughters, and Kristen has three great jobs: mother, farmer, and writer. Since the publication of The Dirty Life, Kristen has written for O Magazine about what it's like to change your life completely, for Vogue on physical work, and for Gourmet Live on all sorts of farm and food-related subjects. The Kimballs have been featured in the Burlington Free Press, Food and Wine, and French L. As I said, I spoke to Kristen Kimball in 2011. We actually did the interview in front of an audience at the South Burlington Community Library in South Burlington, Vermont. And toward the end of the interview, we did take questions from the audience, and you'll be able to hear that. Thanks for listening, and here is my interview with Kristen Kimball. So I thought I'd begin by just reading a little edited version of the back cover copy of The Dirty Life to introduce what the book is about, and then we can start talking. So the copy is this. When Kristen Kimball left New York City to interview a dynamic young farmer named Mark, her world changed. On an impulse, she shed her city self and started a new farm with him on 500 acres near Lake Champlain. The Dirty Life is the captivating chronicle of the couple's first year on Essex Farm, from the cold North Country winter through their harvest season wedding in the loft of the barn. So have you always been impulsive?
Yes. I think, yes, my mother would agree with that. Absolutely. It has manifested in different ways. When I was in college, I quit college for a while and went to Hawaii to write a travel guide, and stayed in Hawaii because I fell in love with the island, and eventually did make my way back to school and graduated. But that was the first of many leaps. Mm-hmm. And this one that I took, I think everybody is hoping, is my last.
How did the memoir begin for you, and what was your original vision of it?
Well, originally, and I know some of you have read the book and others haven't, but originally I was a freelancer in New York City. I had read Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, and I was fascinated by what he was telling us about our food system and what was going wrong with it, but I wanted to see what it looked like when people were doing it differently, when people were farming organically and farming small acreage and selling food to their neighbors. And so originally the book was me looking for a young farmer to write about objectively. And then when I fell in love with him and fell in love with farming, it became a much more personal story, and it took a much longer time to get it out, because our first 3 years together were really full-time more than full-time farming, getting the farm started.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, I wanted to just mention that right from the beginning, you have this wonderful way of introducing the idea of unlikely combinations being a theme in this book. And one example that you use is that your husband's a fabulous cook, and he made a dish that combined pomegranates and radishes, and it was delicious. And I loved that you made a metaphor from that of your being happy as a farmer after leaving your life as a writer in the city. So anyway, I just enjoyed that metaphor, and I loved reading all the recipes and all of the stages. I think one thing that's wonderful about this book is it's about farming, and it's about how you cook after you've got the product, and it's about your relationship and your life. So I thought that was a nice way to start.
Thanks.
So early on, you had differences with Mark in your approaches to life. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about settling into a life with somebody who had such a very different background and such a strong focus on what he wanted to do.
Oh, sure. Mark, the only thing in this book that has embarrassed Mark, despite how much I've revealed about him, is me talking about what he calls his magic circle. He has this belief that he's surrounded by a sort of force field of luck, and that what he wants in life will come to him because he has this magic circle. When I say that, he has said that to me verbatim, but when I say that, it makes him blush. You can say anything else you want about him, but his magic circle makes him blush. So he holds that belief. I'm a much more, pragmatic kind of person. And so when we started looking for a farm together, he believed that this farm would just sort of come to us. And I got highly annoyed at him because I wanted to get a real estate agent and, you know, look through the newspaper and do it the normal way. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. You know, this farm will come to us. It's going to be free. It's going to be exactly what we want. And it's going to happen within 9 months. And I thought, oh, this man. And 9 months to the day from when he said that, we found our farm. And it was free. It was perfect. And it's where we live today. So we have different approaches, but somehow, thus far, we managed to create something harmonious together.
And the way that it came to you was through a landowner who liked your vision for what you were going to do and wanted to help. Is that sort of a...
Yeah. Mark had an idea that instead of growing vegetables, which was what he was doing when we met, he wanted to grow a full diet for a certain number of people year-round. Which in our part of the world means, you know, we have a 100-day growing season in which to do that.
Right.
And luckily I didn't know how nutty that was because I was an ignorant city girl. But it was, it's made for a very interesting farm and a very interesting experience for both of us.
Yeah. Well, in mentioning that, I have a question later, but I'll go to it now. This is, if I may read a quote from the book, this is sort of a description of the kind of farm they wanted to have. By the time we'd gotten to Essex, Mark's notion of a whole diet CSA was complete. He wanted to build a farm that was so diversified it could supplant the supermarket, the kind of farm our great-grandparents' generation grew up on, but built big enough to feed a community instead of just a family. We would produce everything our members needed, beginning with the edible, a variety of meats, eggs, milk and dairy products, grains and flours, vegetables, fruits, and at least one kind of sweetener, but expanding eventually to include all the other things a farm could provide, like firewood and building materials, exercise and recreation. The farm itself should be a self-sustaining organism, producing as much as possible its own energy, fertility, and resources. So how far out are we from that original plan, and how's it going?
We're pretty much there as far as the food goes. We provide what I would consider a full diet for almost 200 people now. Our household still buys in certain things like rice and beer and other things that we consider necessities that we don't produce. But I would say 90% of our calories come from the farm.
Uh-huh.
And for the members, it varies. Some people are very dedicated to the idea of not going to the grocery store, and they live completely off of the share. And other people supplement their share with things from the grocery store. We have added soap to our non-food items. We make our own soap from extra fat and lard from the pigs. But so far, that's our. We don't do firewood. We don't do building materials. We do provide a place for people to hike and have their recreation. But I think Mark would, if he could dream about the future, he would like to see, you know, much more than what we're doing right now.
How many people work on the farm?
We have 8 full-time employees this summer, which is the biggest we've ever been. And we also have a few summer workers and volunteers who come and help mostly in the vegetable field for the summer season where things are really crazy. And on a day like today, we need every single one of them. This is a big hay-making week for us, and everybody's out cutting or throwing around hay or else in the vegetable fields weeding.
Okay, great. I loved, going back to your early days with Mark, I loved your description of pretending that you were some kind of exchange student destined to return to your native land and how this helped you feel like everything was going to be all right, you know. So to what extent were you sort of deceiving yourself early on in this project?
Oh, entirely. Entirely. That's what got me through the first year. And, you know, like your first question sort of pointed out, at first, it was the novelty of this life and farming that I loved so much. And it really wasn't until that first year was over and I had to make a decision to commit, both to Mark and to the farm, that I really understood what this life would be and what I was getting into. And I don't think I was ready to handle that the first year. It took a year for that idea to sink in.
And so you just didn't let yourself worry about it until it was time to accept it.
Exactly. Exactly. Denial is a very powerful and sometimes positive force.
As I was reading The Dirty Life, I started to wonder if you would think marriage is harder for farming families than it is for others, or if it's easier.
No, I think it's both. Mm. We have 2 children now, but the farm was really our first child, and it was this thing that we both cared about passionately, which is both something that bonds 2 people together, but can also create conflict, especially between 2 people who are as opinionated as Mark and I are. But it's very hard for me to imagine what it would be like to be married to somebody who went off to a job in the morning and then came home, and I went off to a job in the morning, and then we came home and said, you know, how was your day, honey? It's never been like that for Mark and for me. And the only way I know him is through this common goal that we have that's very absorbing. But it's intense, and we are a lot of things to each other. We're not just husband and wife. We're also work partners. We're business partners. We're strategists. We're parents. And that can be a very tight relationship, and it also can be kind of complicated.
Yeah.
So I think it's both.
Yeah. I would have a hard time getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to milk the cows, just as far as like what you were saying about saying goodbye to your husband every day. It's like, I'm thinking about milking cows at 4.
Like, we don't milk at 4 anymore, though.
You don't?
6.
Okay. Awesome. how difficult did you find it to write honestly about your family and Mark's family? Both of these families figure prominently in the early part of the book because they're both a little concerned, I think, about everything that you're starting to jump into. But so it's a really honest and beautiful depiction of your families, I thought, and I wondered how hard it was for you to write, knowing they probably would read it someday.
I think that it's there's a blessing that you get with your first book, which is that you really can write it and pretend that nobody is ever going to read it.
And you're an exchange student and you're going home.
You get me. And I think I was able to do that with this book. By the time publication rolled around and it was becoming more and more real that it was going to be out in the world, I think I went through the manuscript again with a pretty fine-tooth comb thinking, can I live with writing this about this person that I love? Are they going to be hurt? I had a wonderful editor who specializes in memoir, and she helped me pick out some of the things that might hurt somebody's feelings. And so by the time it came out, I think it was in a place where the people who read it, I hope, were not offended by it and were hopefully able to laugh at the way that they were depicted.
Yeah.
I hope.
Well, I mean, I don't know these people, but I did think that as the book went on, their love for you became much more tangible, mm-hmm. you know, particularly as you're planning your wedding and it's happening and everybody's, I don't want to give anything away. They did get married. and it's a great, that whole part was great. I loved it. I wanted to mention the humor in the book. A couple of my favorite lines were, seed catalogs would pile up next to the bed like farmer porn. and at one point you were relying on the Amish friends that you had from Mark's earlier work for helping you get started. And at one point the Amish were eyeing your clothes, and you make an aside in the book, it's something when the Amish think you dress funny. So anyway, I loved the humor in the book, and I wondered if you found yourself walking around with a pencil and a piece of paper in your back pocket all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
I think that's, as a writer, the best advice I can give people. I didn't have time to write a book our first year or 2 years, but I did have time to take notes, and so I always keep a notebook on me, and I try to also take notes before I go to sleep. No matter how tired I am, just get down what happened that day, because that's my raw material. I don't do well making things up from scratch, but as long as I have some notes on me, I'm good to go.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I'm wondering if maybe this is a good time for you to read a couple pages
sure.
from the book. And the book is published by Scribner.
So I picked a section toward the end of spring, and I think what you need to know for this section is that We were using draft horses for our field work, and our first team was a pair of Belgian geldings named Sam and Silver. They were about 14 years old when we bought them, and they weighed about 2,000 pounds each. I think that's all you need to know. Okay. We were learning slowly, but everything needed to be done quickly. There was one moment of triumph during potato planting week. The potatoes, 1,000 pounds of them, had already been cut into golf ball-sized hunks. Each hunk had at least one eye on it, where the white sprouts were already beginning to emerge. It was a Friday, and we'd spent the morning and noontime harvesting more nettles, moving milk to the distribution refrigerator, and making cuts of beef. In the afternoon, while I finished arranging the share for the members, Mark hitched the horses to the cultivator, with one large spade attached straight down the middle. He used it to dig the trenches, taking care to dig them straight, perfectly parallel, 40 inches apart. If he wiggled, cultivation and hilling later in the season would be impossible, at least without digging up the very potatoes we were planting. Mark was good at straight lines from the beginning, which I took as a sign of his upright character. As evening settled in, I took the team from him and put them up in their stalls, still harnessed, then ran back to the field to help him drop the cut potatoes into their trenches 10 inches apart. Before we were finished, the sun had set, and the potatoes still had to be covered. There was a stretch of rain predicted to begin the next day, and we were close to the end of the window for potato planting. Tired as we were, if we wanted potatoes for the year, it had to be done. Mark kept dropping potatoes, speeding along the rows at a run, while I went back to the barn. Following his hurried instructions, I wrenched the spade off the cultivator and replaced it with a pair of discs set on an inward-facing V to push the loose soil over the potatoes in their trench. Then I went to the barn for the dozing horses and rehitched them. Like us, they had already worked overtime that day, and they were probably expecting I'd turn them out on pasture for the night. I hated to ask them to work again, but we didn't have much choice. I was starting to distrust anthropomorphic feelings by then. I suspected that to assign human emotions to animals was to underestimate the beasts. But Sam certainly moved with a sense of purpose that night, leaning into the bit and picking up his feet on the way to the field, practically dragging sluggish old Silver with him. I had never used the cultivator before, but Mark was the faster potato dropper, so I drew the job of teamster. The wheels and the discs adjust by foot pedal, so the trick is to try to watch where the horses are going and watch the ground underneath your seat, both at the same time. You must keep the row centered perfectly between the horses so that the naked potatoes get buried completely. I found that I was not so good at straight lines, and wondered what that meant about my character. Sam, though, was the teacher's pet in our little class of two. And either he had cultivated row crops before, or he was a very fast learner. At the end of a row, I'd woe the team to disengage the heavy discs, and Sam would flick one ear back, listening for the cue to turn. In the pasture, Silver was the undisputed king. But in harness, when he knew the answers, Sam was not afraid to assert himself. He nudged Silver through the turns, sometimes laying his ears back and throwing his weight into it, with attitude. The moon rose, but it was no help, a pale splinter flanked by the fat spring Venus. By the time we were three-quarters finished, it was truly dark. Mark was still sprinting along the final trenches, dropping potatoes. I couldn't see where the rows started anymore. I was about to yell to Mark that we had to quit and go in when I realized that Sam knew exactly what we were doing and could see better in the dark than I could. Soon as we rounded a turn, I'd give him a loose line, and he'd find the right place at the top of the row and stop. Silver kerthumped along next to him. When I asked them to step up, the potatoes were right where they were supposed to be, passing between my feet, vague white orbs in deep shadow, and I had nothing to do with it. We finished the whole field that way, the horses' backs steaming in the chilly night air. To this day, I don't know why they work for us so willingly. They are big enough to say no, but they keep saying yes, even at the end of a long day, even in the dark.
Thank you for reading it.
My pleasure.
That's a great section.
Thank you.
Yeah. Are you still in charge of the horses on the farm?
I'm not. I wish I were. I don't get nearly enough time behind them. We have one of our eight employees is a really wonderful horseman, mm-hmm. and he's in charge of our hitches. As we've gotten bigger, we've had to figure out different ways of hitching and using the horses, mm-hmm. because two horses is a lot slower than a tractor, as you might imagine. But we've started hitching four and six horses together so that they can pull larger machinery, because it's a lot easier to hire another horse than it is to hire another person. Mm-hmm. And those big hitches I'm not quite comfortable with yet. This weekend I should get a lot of time cutting hay. We do that with two horses and a sickle bar mower, and I love that work. So if I can find a babysitter, that's where I'll be this weekend.
Do you have people that are just always babysitting for you so you can do the farming, or do you have to, like, keep looking every week?
No, I love spending time with my kids.
Yeah.
And we have a baby who's 9 months old and a four-year-old, and since the baby's been born, I've been more full-time mom than I have a full-time farmer. Mm-hmm. I manage to do both simultaneously sometimes, and we do have babysitters who cover the kids some mornings, but I've been doing more mom duty than I have farming duty.
Uh-huh. Okay. So did Mark have any input in the book?
He was invaluable because he also kept notes our first year. And so I could look at his notes and my notes together. And he's a wonderful editor, so he looked at the manuscript after every draft and had really good advice and good things to add or things to take away.
Uh-huh. Oh.
And he, you know, aside from the magic circle, not embarrassed about things that I said about him. So,
did he want you to take that out?
Yes, he did.
He really did.
And I wouldn't.
Let's talk about the book's structure. Mm-hmm. You have a prologue and then a section called Leaving, mm-hmm. where you're making the transition away from your old life. And then you have four sections that are based around the four seasons, starting with winter, and then an epilogue. And eventually you include some recipes that sort of coincide with the four seasons. Did you play with any other structures, and how did you decide to stay with this one, which I thought was great, but I'm just curious.
Structure is not my strong suit, and it always comes last for me. And I really had a lot of help from my editor. I had two editors who helped me at the publishing house, and we really wrestled with structure in my last draft of the manuscript. And we decided it would be chronological, but it took a little bit of wrangling to decide that it was going to be broken down into seasons. And then when we decided that it would be seasons, it just seemed so obvious. My only worry was that it seemed a bit cliche, because farm books are often broken down into four seasons, but it just worked, and I needed something to hang those stories on. So
right. It's so helpful once you figure out how you want to craft it into a shape.
Yeah.
So when you first moved to Essex, or when you first actually started looking at land in Essex, you met some of the people there, and the reactions were fairly skeptical from people who knew farming and knew the area. There was one neighbor who I loved. I was so happy for him to have been in your life at that time, Shep Shields, who gave some great advice and was very supportive. I'm just wondering if, not to set you up here, but do you remember how to describe the advice that he gave?
Yes, I remember completely. He's still my neighbor. I changed his name because I didn't want to embarrass him, so that's not his real name.
Okay.
He's probably almost 90 now, and he said if he were a young man, he would farm small again. He'd watched so many dairies in our neighborhood go out of business because they had gotten too big and they collapsed under debt. And he said if he were a young man, he would start small and he would have a small herd of Jerseys, and he would feed people. He would feed his neighbors and his friends and actually produce something that people eat, which sounds so obvious when you're thinking of farming, but if you're growing a commodity crop or putting all your milk into a bulk tank, you're not feeding people that you know. And he also said that he would do it with horses. He loves horses. He's one of the last old teamsters around us who grew up with horses in his bones. And I think it's part of that great love for horses that he has, but he also has seen that horses really can do the kind of work that we're asking them to do. And on a smallish scale, they're not completely crazy. They make some sense. And so it was really nice to have that voice in the neighborhood, and to have that skill set and that deep knowledge of, you know, the way that farming used to be done.
Mm-hmm. And his excitement about the way you were going to do it probably made him open to questions and asking for advice. And,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Do people ever come to the farm out of curiosity because they've read the book?
We do get some drop-bys. And it's hard because we then sort of have to stop working and greet people and say, you know, don't touch the electric fence. So we've decided to set up seasonal tours so that people can come when we have made the time to show people around and talk about what we do. We love telling people what we do, but it's hard to have a sort of flow of people coming onto the farm all the time.
Right, right. I would think that would make it really hard if you've got certain deadlines that have to be dealt with.
Exactly.
Because of weather or whatever. Pretty much throughout the book, once you begin farming, you write about the changes that took place for you physically as you were starting this aspect of your life, and you write about your muscles getting, you know, stronger, and you write about the outside, being outside, and how you've noticed it changing the way that you looked. So, and I loved that part because I thought that was a really important aspect of what it would be like for a woman to go from being somebody who worked, you know, in journalism to going to somebody who worked outside. So, but it sounded like you kind of relaxed into it eventually. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I think I just turned 40. And I think at 40, and even a little bit before I turned 40, there was a realization that who you are and what you look like is an accurate reflection of who you are and what you do. And I became okay with that, even though I have, you know, wrinkles around my eyes and freckles and sunspots. And I have a sister who's 10 years older than I am. And often people now say, who's the older sister? So it took me a while to become comfortable with that, but I'm okay with it. It's just who I am.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of what we do. And I'm quite comfortable with it now.
And then as far as becoming a stronger petite woman, do you feel, I mean, I would think that feels pretty good.
It feels great.
Yeah.
I love having a useful body. When I lived in the city, you know, we all did our yoga and jogged around the park in order to fit into our skinny jeans. But it's so much more fun to have a body that's really useful and strong and that I can rely on.
Right. And you don't have to go on a Stairmaster in order to.
Exactly. Yeah.
So have your neighbors read the book, do you know?
I think they have, yes.
Do people mention it?
Yes, and I've gotten really nice comments from people who are in the book and who have read it. A few I haven't heard from, but I think I would hear of it if it's a town of 700 people, so I think I would hear of it if people were upset by it. So I haven't heard anything negative.
Okay. If people have questions that they've written down, in a couple minutes or now, whatever, you can pass them over to be brought up, and then we'll ask those. Okay, so I was going to ask, who are a few of your favorite authors? Who do you like to read?
Well, I love Mary Carr. I think she's just a fabulous memoirist, and she taught me a lot about...
She wrote The Liars Club?
She wrote The Liars Club and mm-hmm. Cherry and Lit, which is a newer one. She taught me a lot about how it's almost always better to be perfectly honest, even when it's not flattering. So I love her books. She always makes me laugh. I really love Joan Didion. Mm-hmm. She's one of my favorites for her keen sense of observation. And so when I read her, I always take a lesson on how she is reporting on the world around her at all times. I love Verlaine Klinkenborg, who writes about rural life. He has a very rich texture of language, and I like that. And Wendell Berry is a deep old favorite because he has taught all of the people in my generation what farming is all about. So
okay.
Those are writers that I particularly had in mind when I was writing this book.
Mm-hmm. Great. All right, well, I have one last question. I have three potential last questions, so I'm going to pick one.
Okay.
one of them I think somebody else will ask you, so I'm going to... So I wonder if you have advice for people who are in the position of changing their lives for love.
Do it.
Okay, we're done.
I don't know many people who regret the leap. I know a lot of people who regret not leaping.
So I'll just start to go through these and we can take more as we go.
Okay.
I'm just going to repeat the questions and let's see. We'll just go in the order they are here. So would you speak about water, water conservation, ponds, erosion, etc. on the farm?
Sure. Essex Farm is a very wet farm. Our problem with water is not having not enough of it. Our problem is always an overabundance of water. It used to be called the Gladwater Farm because there's so many springs on it and it lies so low. That's partly why its soil is so beautiful. But drainage is always our trickiest issue. And on a year like this, when we have had record rains, both in April and May, it's a really challenging year to farm our piece of land. Our neighbors told us that when we moved in, and they were absolutely right. So we are working with some deep tillage methods to try to loosen up some of the hard subsoil. And we're thinking of actually putting in tile, which is a system to drain fields that are too wet. It'll be very interesting to see. You know, everybody around us says that the 8 years that we've been on our farm have been the 8 most extreme years weather-wise that they've seen. And it'll be very interesting to see in the next, hopefully, 50 years that we're farming there, what happens. I suspect that climate change will bring us some surprises, and we'll have to be pretty crafty, creative farmers to figure ways through it.
Mm-hmm. What have the past 24 hours of your dirty life been like?
Let's see, what have I done in the last 24 hours? I had to run farm errands today in Plattsburgh, which is where we go for all of our supplies. I had to go to the USDA office. I had to go to the welding store. And I had to go to pick up some tools at the hardware store. So I had 2 kids with me. And going to the welding store with 2 kids is an experience that everybody should have once in a lifetime. As the children are,
I've never brought my kids to the welding store. I'm
tipping over the acetylene tank, and that reminds me that a book that I would like to write at some point in the future is what it's like to be a woman learning the trades as an adult, trying to figure out what these stupid tools are called and how they're used, and this whole language of the shop that we as girls are never taught. Our brothers usually are, but we as girls are not. And it's such a challenge to me. It's like learning a foreign language. And I would love to write about, you know, what it's like to actually learn basic welding skills and basic carpentry and small engine repair as an adult, because it's tough and foreign.
And do you do all that?
People try to not let me do it because I'm slow and I often get it wrong.
Okay.
But I'm curious about it, and I'd like to learn to be better about it in the future.
How did you actually meet Mark? Were you looking for land in a specific sale? And then what do you do in the winter?
Mm-hmm.
And how many years did it take you to write the book?
Okay, great questions. I met Mark because I went to interview him about farming. And in a very unprofessional move, I fell in love with him. You're not supposed to do that when you're interviewing somebody. And our land, what was that second question about the land? Did we find the land? The land that we farm, we found together. Mark was farming in Pennsylvania when we met. He couldn't build a home on the land that he was farming there. And so when we decided that we were going to try to make a life together, he left his farm. I left my apartment in New York, and we went looking for a farm to start together. And that's how we found Essex Farm. The land was owned by a friend of his family, and who didn't live on it, still does not live on it. And we came up to look at it from downstate and decided to give it a shot. And then there's one more.
What do you do in the winter?
Winter is the time when we try to catch up on all the things that have fallen apart in the summer. So we do building repair. We fix machinery. We still have a lot of farm chores to do. Animals, you know, need to be fed and watered in the winter. The cows need to be milked every single day. So winter is not, it's not a vacation, but because the days are just shorter, there's less that you can do, and there's a little bit of time in the evenings to, you know, sit by the wood stove and read a book or make a fancy dinner or catch up with your kids and your spouse. So it's a little bit more relaxed, but there's more to do in the winter than you might think, especially on a winter like this past one when we had so much snow and had to figure out ways of, you know, moving hay out to the beef herd when we had 4 or 5 foot snow drifts.
Right. They all still have to eat and get milked. And
yep, exactly.
And then how many years did it take you to write the book?
It took me about 3 years, which is kind of ridiculously long for a short book, but there was a lot of other stuff going on at the same time. So.
Okay. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with the handwriting. Whose is this?
As a graduate of Harvard.
Oh, as a Harvard. I thought it said as a Howard grandmother. I'm like, what does that mean? As a Harvard graduate, how did you feel about those without formal education? And how do you feel now, especially in regard to how one defines intelligence?
Oh, that's a great question. I wrote in the book that I had always just had this assumption, an unexamined assumption in my head, that abstract things were for smart people and material things were for people who weren't that smart. So if you were smart enough, you'd go to law school and become a lawyer, and if you weren't that smart, you'd become a carpenter or a plumber or something like that. And as I began the work of becoming a farmer, that idea was completely blown out of the water in a very humbling, humbling way. I realized my own ignorance and my own lack of basic intelligence in the physical world, and I realized that somebody who's a genius at fixing cars or fixing wood, working with wood or any of the other trades, is as much of a genius as somebody is who can write a law brief or, you know, do any other sort of white-collar job. So it was a very humbling experience and also just a great expansion of what was obviously a silly belief that I held.
As a result of living so close to the land with a mystic of souls, have you become...
Of sorts, sorry.
Have you become more mystical?
Yes, but not in a way that I thought I would. I find, I'm not a religious person, but I find something deeply spiritual about working closely with the land. I just find that there's so much mystery in the way that things grow and the way that animals are born and breed and die. it's farming more than living with Mark that has made me more of a mystic or more spiritual.
What, if anything, do you miss from city life?
So many things. I miss, strangely, I miss the anonymity of being in a city. Mm-hmm. The fact that I could walk out my door and nobody would know me. Don't get me wrong, I love living in a small town. I love that I know my neighbors. But I do miss, you know, being able to walk out my door and know that I could walk down the street and nobody would know or care where I was going or what I was up to or what, you know, I'd had for breakfast. I miss bars and movie theaters and those public spaces where you can just go without effort and be. I miss the diverse ethnic mix of the city, both, you know, in the human landscape and also in the culinary landscape. I miss sort of, you know, having a choice of all sorts of different foods. Mm. But mostly I miss my sister. She lived right across town from me in New York, and I miss that daily closeness that we had. It's a 5-hour drive door to door, and we don't get to do it that often. So.
Right. Has your life gotten easier or harder during the years since you wrote the book?
Both. We, you know, it was really different when we started hiring people to have all this work that would get done that neither Mark nor I had done ourselves. but it's also, you know, when you found something, when you start something, it's really hard to let go of it and to let go of the that sort of creator's energy of crafting a place from the ground up. And our life is really crowded now. You know, our farm is also our home, and there's 8 people who work on it every day. And so it's sometimes hard for me to share that space. Mm-hmm. But it's also amazing to see what 8 people can do agriculturally when they're working hard and having a good time.
Do any of those people live on the farm with you?
Nobody lives there. A few of our summer people are there temporarily. We have a couple cabins on the farm, but none of our full-timers live on farm. They all live in town or nearby.
Okay, and then this last question I'm going to put a little addendum on because nobody asked the other question I was thinking of. So this last question is, what will your next book be about? And my other question was, when do you find time to write?
Mm-hmm. I've just started working on the next book, and it's about what it's like to have a working relationship with animals. The horses are still my very favorite part of the farm, and I think I'm going to be starting a colt, a yearling colt that we're getting in the next couple weeks. And so the book's going to be framed by the training of this colt. But it's also about the kind of agricultural 7-year itch. You know, this is our 8th year on the farm. It's not new anymore. Mark and I have been married for 7 years. And what's it like to sort of face that and dig in and find the beauty in what we do when it's not a novelty anymore?
Mm-hmm. And when do you write?
I write early in the morning.
4 o'clock.
Yeah, pretty much. My best hours are between 4 and 7. Mm-hmm. Our kids tend to wake up around 7, so if I can get a few hours in before they wake up, it's better. And I have to leave the farm. I always leave the farm to write. I go to the firehouse that's a mile down the road because it's quieter than our farmhouse. And I have a little broom closet there where I can go in, close the door, and be alone. So that's where I do most of my good work.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming here and talking with us.
Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kristen Kimball. You can learn more about her work and the Essex Farm at her website, kristenkimball.com. And just to repeat what I said at the beginning of the show, I do have a new interview to air this week, but it can't go on the air until tomorrow due to the publisher's restrictions. The author Stephen Kirkjian has written a new book, Master Thieves, which is about the Gardner Museum heist, which is now 25 years ago. So that book comes out tomorrow, and I will get that podcast of that interview up tomorrow or the next day, and I will also air it on the Radiator at a future date, some Monday in the future I'll air that interview. So, Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Main Street Landing, creating places for people to work, play, entertain, meet, eat, and greet on Burlington's beautiful waterfront. Main Street Landing rents office and retail space as well as daily rentals for meetings, events, and performances in their Performing Arts Center. Contact Melinda at 802-864-7999 or visit mainstreetlanding.com online for more information. And we are also supported by Calamity and Crows Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crows Trading Post on Facebook for more information. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by the interview that I'm going to air tomorrow, which is about the Gardner Museum heist. Write about a theft. From bubblegum slipped into a small pocket to a painting removed while an alarm goes off, theft can make for interesting fiction, probably also poetry and nonfiction. Certainly nonfiction, because the book I'm airing the interview of tomorrow is nonfiction. Who commits the crime and why? Who is the victim? Is it an elderly woman missing her purse, or is it a huge corporation missing their computer files? Is the thief conflicted? What does he or she stand to gain? Consider all the parties and all the angles and write something about a theft. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book or on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast and my new blog, The Silent G, which I haven't written in ages, but I will soon, by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. At that website, you can also read more about my own work, including my novel Shape of the Sky, which has just come out for the Kindle. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And finally, do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.